evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Former Texas police officer sentenced to 15 years in prison for fatally shooting teen. Roy Oliver, the 38-year-old former police officer, was sentenced late yesterday to 15 years in prison for fatally shooting the unarmed African-American teen, Jordan Edwards, as Edwards and friends were leaving a house party in a Dallas suburb last year. Oliver could be eligible for parole after serving half of his sentence. Jordan Edwards was a high school freshman and was lauded as a model student. Mumia Abu-Jamal's appeal request continued. Arguments in a request by former death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal to have his previous appeals vacated have been postponed. The district attorney's office turned over a document Monday that defense says could show state Supreme Court Justice Ronald Castillo was personally involved in the case. Today, the judge ordered the parties to continue searching for additional documents before he hears arguments in October. U.S. is denying passports to Americans along the border, throwing their citizenship into question. The State Department has cracked down on issuing passports amid the Trump administration's accusations that possibly thousands of Hispanic citizens along the southern border have been using fake birth certificates their entire lives. The State Department said citizenship fraud has been frequent along the U.S.-Mexico border, with citizens having birth certificates in the United States and Mexico. Quote, such persons often use documents to obtain passports and other benefits from both governments. Mexico and the United States, the department said in a statement. Some passport applicants with official U.S. birth certificates are being jailed in detention facilities as they await immigration proceedings, while others have had their passports revoked when they tried to reenter the U.S. The State Department, under the Bush administration and Obama administrations, investigated this based on a 1993 case in which a midwife pled guilty to selling Texas birth certificates to parents of children born in Mexico. After the government settled in a case involving the American Civil Liberties Union in 2009, the number of passport denials dropped off. Now the government is denying passports to those it suspects of having fraudulent birth certificates at an increasing rate, regardless of whether they were delivered by midwives. Detroit schools turn off drinking water, citing elevated lead and copper. When public school students in Detroit return to their classrooms next week for the first day of school year, the water fountains will be dry. Since 2016, water testing in the district has found elevated levels of lead or copper in dozens of schools. And while it is unclear how many of the district's 106 schools currently have water quality issues, the drinking water will be turned off for all of them. The latest round of water quality tests was conducted this year, and the results for 24 schools came in last week. Of those, 16 had at least one water source and elevated levels of copper and lead, or both. That, coupled with testing results from 2016, brought the total number of schools with known water issues to 34. We are the richest nation in the world. We can bomb Syria. We can bomb Yemen, killing school buses full of school children. But we can't provide clean drinking water to American children in public schools. Syria delivers evidence to UN showing Idlib rebel preparations to stage false flag chemical attack. All of this while Pentagon and U.S. officials continue to set the stage to play the Assad is gassing his own people card. During a speech delivered on Tuesday to the UN Security Council, Syria's permanent representative Bashir al Jafari, claimed to have provided information to the council that was evidence that armed opposition groups, including al-Qaeda affiliate al-Nusra Front, were gearing up to use chemical weapons against civilians in the Syrian province of Idlib in an effort to frame the Syrian government for the attack. Jafari's warning comes as Syria and its allies are preparing for a major military offensive that would target the rebel-held Idlib province, which even mainstream Western outlets admit is dominated by terrorist groups and their affiliates. Here's the point. Idlib is the last rebel stronghold. If it falls, Assad wins the war. The only way the rebels can get the U.S. and other forces to engage is another false flag attack. Don't fall for it. We'll see how all this shakes out. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Oklahoma voters continued a red state trend this past Tuesday night by throwing out half a dozen incumbent Republican lawmakers who voted against a tax hike to fund teacher pay increases. In Arizona, educators made a number of electoral gains in Democratic Party primaries based upon similar issues. Is there a resurgence of the power of unions in this country? Oklahoma, West Virginia, Arizona, Washington State teachers all are gaining ground. For insight into this, we turn to my first guests. The co-editor-in-chief of Lukeman Nation, co-host of the Facebook live stream Coffee, Current Events, and Politics, Jackie Lukeman. I am well, thank you. And we are also joined by her other half, Brother Abdul Lukeman.
Yes, sir.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Oklahoma, this is kind of a long setup, but let me get through this. Oklahoma's teachers protested by the thousands, demanding higher pay and better funding for public education. In West Virginia, the teachers won all five of their demands by shutting down every public school in the state earlier this year. Teachers in Arizona started the hashtag Red for Ed movement, wearing red t-shirts and engaging in protests to push the state government to increase funding for public education. On Tuesday night, teachers and others supportive of the protests won Democratic primaries for state seats. Finally, nearly 80,000 students in Washington State were unable to attend the first day of school this week as thousands of teachers went on strike seeking higher salaries, teachers' union said. Coupled with the recent federal district court ruling on Trump's executive order setting up further debate over federal collective bargaining, here's the question. Is there a resurgence of union power in this country? Jackie, ladies first.
Well, I think that there is a resurgence of union power because people didn't expect the Janus ruling. I think a lot of labor pundits really did not expect that ruling to come out the way it did. So people didn't expect unions to be threatened the way that ruling did. But here's the other half of that. This is not just a resurgence of the power of labor unions. It's also a general pushback against GOP small government policies. Because if we remember in the last few midterm elections where the Tea Party gained these state houses all across the country, most of these states are Tea Party run states where these governors have advocated for small government and, you know, they told people this is what you wanted as an American. You know, this is what America should look like. Well, now, however many years later, voters see that small government looks like underfunded public schools, underpaid teachers, crumbling infrastructure, and government not using resources that are in the government coffers to pay for services that taxpayers expect to get. And especially when it comes to the education of their children, I mean, people were fine with certain groups of people being targeted for, you know, not getting certain benefits, quote unquote, entitlements. But when people can't send their child to school every day because the public school doesn't have enough money literally to run, to stay open every day, to pay the teachers and to keep the lights on, people get angry, and they get angry at the politicians who cause that. And this is a backlash against that.
Abdu, before you respond, to Jackie's point, people fail to remember how before the Reagan administration, and Jackie, you were talking about fairly current midterm elections, but we go back to the Reagan administration, states were receiving funding from block grant programs, other types of federal revenue sharing programs that provided much needed funding to states for education. Right. And Reagan comes in, this whole movement of smaller government and taking away the money that was going to the states in order to what? Pay for that defense budget. And now we have that with the neoliberal privatization foolishness that's going on and the whole charter school movement. That has really contributed to this attack on public education.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And I'm glad you brought up Reagan. I'm glad you brought up Reagan because it was during Reagan that these attacks on unions increased, too. I'm really glad to see the teachers really pushing back. Because the GOP has been trying to destroy the teachers' union for as long as I can remember. But to answer your question more directly, I think this is a resurgence of unions pushing back, especially the teachers' union pushing back. I think that, that as Jackie said, that they're seeing that, especially in places like Oklahoma, when the fracking industry is given such tax breaks and you know, they say, well, there's no money to pay teachers, but yet they can afford to give tax breaks to the fracking industry and everything else. And Jackie, you're right. I think that people are seeing that, you know, hey, you know, we're just not going to take it. And I'm glad that the teachers are pushing back on it.
It is amazing to me, and I keep going back to this point because I don't think folks really get it, how Trump can sign a $719 billion defense bill, mm-hmm. but teachers must protest by the thousands mm-hmm. to demand higher pay and better funding for public education. Jackie, what does this say about the priorities in the country?
So the priorities in the country have been backward, upside down, inside out for a very long time. People are making the public outcry from a group of people that they weren't expecting to protest, right? Like, people are used to seeing us protest. Right? They're like, why are the black people protesting today? You know, what they mad at today? But when predominantly white teachers in West Virginia take to the streets and fill up the chambers of the state legislature in protest in Oklahoma, in Arizona, and they stand in the chambers and they are being openly insulted and chided by legislators for, you know, you're whining and you know, people are looking at that and going, wait a minute, that's not Trump. That's something else. That didn't just happen in 2016. So we have finally, I think what we keep saying in Lukeman Nation, we're seeing that it's finally happening. Like, the things that we have been experiencing as black people, as the oppressed class in this country, the things that we have been experiencing, that we've been telling people, look, this has been done to us for decades, centuries, because people ignored that for so long. Now it's happening to them.
The problem with that is it's happening to them, but they have been sold this story that it's our fault.
Right.
It's Mexicans' faults. Mm-hmm. Under every rock, you're going to find an evil Russian and a Muslim that are trying to. And I've got a buddy down in Florida. He coined the term I stated it this way. Now you have white people who have been sold the American dream. Right. They're having to mortgage their present to pay for their future.
That's right.
And they've been convinced that because of Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell and all those others who are touting this narrative, they go to the banks and they have to deal with a teller with an accent. They go to a restaurant, they have to deal with a waiter with an accent, and their kids can't find jobs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I have a partner down there, he said, these are the white folks that the real white folks left behind.
Oh, that's good. Wow.
And they're angry.
That's right.
They're really angry. Let's, I'm going to flip. I know you want me to get to this, so I'm going to flip this. Next issue. Trump warned evangelical leaders in a closed-door meeting that there would be violence if Republicans lose the House in the November midterms. Quote, they will overturn everything that we've done, and they'll do it quickly and violently. And violently. There's violence. When you look at Antifa and you look at some of these groups, these are violent people. The level of hatred, the level of anger is unbelievable. Part of it is because of some of the things I've done for you and for me and for my family. But I've done them. Oh, he's stupid.
Yes.
You wanted this.
Yes, you wanted
this. I did. I really did, because as a Christian myself, and as a person who has attended churches in this area with people who, when Barack Obama was running, circulated this myth that he wasn't American. These were good church people. Mm-hmm. Who in very liberal Northern Virginia, who sent around emails talking about, you know, his Nigerian cousins burning down churches full of Christians in Africa and
all, his Mau Mau his Mau Mau politics,
right.
As
uh-huh.
former
right.
Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich,
right, right,
Newt Gingrich and the Indian writer it'll come to anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
He isn't worth remembering.
Oh, yeah, I know who you're talking about. But I try not to say his name.
Put him in the Mau Mau. You have to be concerned about his Mau Mau politics.
Yes, right. Yes. And so, I think the danger that I'm seeing with people's reaction to what Trump said is that people think that Trump is like stirring these people up to something that they don't already feel. That's just. I'm here to tell you from personal experience, these people have a white supremacist, white nationalist view of Christianity, mm-hmm. and they always have. This is not something that Trump had to inspire them to do. Remember, Michelle Bachmann.
Oh, God.
See what I mean? But Michelle Bachmann and that Tea Party crowd, mm-hmm. those people were elected partially because of campaigning done by white evangelical Christians.
Go tell them that Jesus was a Palestinian Jew and see what you get.
Right, and see if you get out of that church alive.
See what you get.
So when I see that Trump said this, number one, it's not a surprise because it's like this is what they thought
that's
about.
That's all he's got left.
Yeah, I mean, that really is all he's got left. That's really what they thought about everybody who doesn't agree with their white Republican Jesus view of Christianity. Anyway, they really do believe that, I mean, they always have believed this for decades, that, you know, if given a chance, everybody who doesn't believe in Christianity the way they do just wants to kill them all. So that this is not Trump's fault. So and then the idea that Trump is creating some monster
right.
among these
people.
No,
he's just awoken the monster.
He really has.
That is America.
And right. he has. And it really, when I read that article, I reposted on my own personal page. I didn't put it on our page, but I reposted on my own personal page. I hope the people I used to go to church with read this because this is your fault.
Quickly, Abdu.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't really say that he might be telling the truth. You know, he said during his campaign that he could shoot somebody in Times Square and the people still love him, you know. And it seems that so far that's holding out to be true. I think there was a story that was just released now. I don't know what happened in Boston, but someone had called up a newspaper and threatened to kill everybody, calling them the enemy of the people.
Right.
So there's a psyche out there that Trump has definitely tapped into. And I look, it wouldn't surprise me if on some scale some violence might happen.
Just to wrap this up, the frightening thing about this is, or one of the frightening things about this is campaign rhetoric. Mm-hmm. Okay. It is excessive. It is extreme. It is hyperbolic, but it is campaign rhetoric. Just about every other president of memory, once they became president, they moved out of campaign mode and they knew that they had to move into governing mode.
Exactly.
And he has never been able to move into governing mode. He continues to stay in campaign mode, only speaking to his base.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is, to me, incredibly frightening. Now I can move back to the final point. I got a couple extra minutes here. Are people, or maybe more directly, just the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. are they ignoring this grassroots, more progressive politics that really seems to be gaining momentum? If you look at Andrew Gilliam in Florida, Stacey Abrams in Georgia, Ben Jealous in Maryland, they could all be the next governors right. of their states. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York, she's going to Congress. There's a woman named Julia Salazar who is running for the New York State Senate in the shadow of Ocasio-Cortez. She's taking up the mantle of sex workers' rights.
Wow.
And here's the interesting thing about those politics. Sex work intersects with labor, mm-hmm. gender, immigration, race, LGBTQ, and criminal justice. She has taken a taboo third rail subject and linked all of those other areas into that. That's, to me, some brilliant, brilliant
That's
politics.
Very brilliant.
Yeah.
So, and she may very well win. Mm-hmm. So, and then we look at Ayanna Pressley
yes.
in Boston,
mm-hmm.
a Democrat running against Mike Capuano,
mm-hmm.
who is the sitting congressional representative sitting in John Kennedy's seat.
Right.
She's a Democrat. He's a Democrat. But she's running simply because the demographics in the district have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And she's saying, you're a wonderful guy, but gotta go, gotta go.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So now. That's a very long lead into, but is Democratic leadership missing this boat?
I think so far, yes. I mean, they're missing the boat. I also think that they don't know what to do with this. You know, I think that, again, I think when we spoke earlier, I think they got caught by surprise by this. Gilliam down in Florida?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gilliam.
Gilliam, right. Mm-hmm. Gilliam down in Florida, who's been endorsed by Bernie Sanders. So you see that the Democratic Party had at one time tried to squash that kind of dissent, the Bernie Sanders, what they call the Bernie Sanders faction. But as they see, it's really growing even more.
Yeah, Gilliam was backed by Sanders.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Ocasio-Cortez backed by Sanders.
Right.
I'm not sure about State. Oh, Ben Jealous.
Ben Jealous
is backed by Sanders.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether Stacey Abrams was or not.
I don't know.
But, okay, no, she wasn't? Okay. But anyway, so Bernie's definitely got his hand in the soup.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
So this goes back to, once again, that when we opened up the show about this grassroots movement that establish that the parties don't know what to do with it, the Democratic Party don't know what to do with it. But also, as we see, that those who are part of the establishment, you know, people want to change. And that's what you see.
And Jackie, folks have been saying for a very long time that the Democrats and the Republicans are two wings on the same bird.
That's right. Yep.
And that what I see when you get pushback from Nancy Pelosi, when you get pushback from what's his name in New York? This is in the Senate.
Schumer.
Chuck mm-hmm. Schumer. Mm-hmm. When the establishment individuals are pushing back yep. on this and pushing back on this hard mm-hmm. because they, in many regards, have been appealing to the very same donor base. Okay, Stacey Abrams did back. I mean, Bernie did back Stacey. Okay, thank you. They're appealing to the same voter base, which is why Barack Obama didn't want to appear to be too black.
Right.
That's a whole other discussion.
That's all part of the mm-hmm. same equation. Those are different factors in the same equation.
Exactly.
We'll let you close it out.
Well, when you have a so-called left party that has had as a strategy for the past 30 years to court white male Republicans, middle American white male Republicans away from the Republican Party, of course, their policies are not going to be people-centric, labor-centric, black-centric, LGBT. Their policies are going to center around those things that middle white male Republican voters are concerned about. And that's it. So we get left behind, and they're still stuck on those policies. Mm-hmm. And those of us who have realized those policies have left us out and we don't like it and we don't owe you our vote just because you're not that other party. They don't know how to respond to that.
And that's here's right. the thing that is so simple and why they don't see this. If the working class, if the labor class is able to provide for themselves a decent standard of living.
Right.
That's everybody right. else will be living off the chart.
Exactly.
That
precisely.
If you are able to do away with poverty or at least minimize poverty to the point where you can say, well, damn, you know, if you're poor, you really want to be.
Right.
If you're able to contract that class mm-hmm. to where your labor class and your working class are thriving, everybody else is going to be doing really, really well.
Precisely. Precisely. If
that's not that math isn't no. too hard to do.
No.
Well, Jackie and Abdu Lukman, thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Oh, pleasure was mine. And the audience enjoyed it, I know. In fact, y'all that are listening, you got to get up and tell somebody about this. About this on Sputnik. You got to tell folks that we're out here because they need to know. All right. Hey, folks, let me tell you this. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I am your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Who is Jeremy Corbyn, and why is he under attack? Well, for insight into this, let's turn to my next guest. He's an author and human rights activist born in Jerusalem. He is the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and Injustice, the Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. He joins us to discuss his latest article in Mint Press News. Anti-Semitism charges against Jeremy Corbyn are diversion from Israeli occupation of Palestine. He is Miko Peled. Welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you again.
Thank you, Miko. I really appreciate it. So first, explain to us, who is Jeremy Corbyn?
Jeremy Corbyn is the leader of the labor movement in the United Kingdom. He's a man whose whole life was dedicated to fighting apartheid in South Africa, fighting racism, fighting for the poor in his own country. And a couple of years ago, he actually made it to become the leader of the Labor Party. And since he became leader of the Labor Party, there have been close to 800,000 Brits who signed up to be members of the party. So today, it's the largest party in Europe. It's unprecedented popularity, unprecedented support. He brought the Labour Party to within a hair's breadth of winning an election. in the last elections. And he's a very popular, very decent, a very principled politician, which is rare these days. And he has a very good chance of becoming Britain's next prime minister.
You write, quote, "Zionist groups within the Labour Party skillfully utilize the pro-Zionist media. They are trying and failing to paint Jeremy Corbyn as an anti-Semite. However, the problem is not anti-Semitism, but Corbyn's stance on Palestine," end quote. Very often people equate the two, pro-Palestine and anti-Semitism. Why is this not necessarily a fair equivalence?
I said it's not a fair equivalence. It's a false equivalence. It suggests that if you don't support the state of Israel 100%, if you don't support Zionism, which is inherently a racist, violent ideology, then you hate Jews. So you're either with the Zionists or you're anti-Semite. Now, Jeremy Corbyn, as part of his struggle against injustice worldwide, has also been a staunch supporter of justice for in Palestine for the Palestinians. He's been outspoken on this issue. Last year at the labor conference in Brighton, which I was, you know, where I was, you know, I was there. He spoke about all of his ideals and all the important things that need to achieve, and he said one sentence. He said one line that there is no politician in the world today who would dare to say, and that is, we must end the oppression of the Palestinian people. There is no leader today in the world who would dare to say those words. And he stood up there at the conference, at the leader's speech, which is the most important speech, of course, and he said this, and he didn't qualify it, and he didn't make any kind of gestures towards the Zionists and towards the state of Israel. It was not conditioned upon anything. He said that we must end the oppression of the Palestinian people. He is a man of principle, and Palestine is one of the principles, you know, justice in Palestine, just like in all other places, is one of the principles which he upholds and he fights for. And this is why there has been a campaign for several years now, since he became leader, to bring him down. The Israelis, the Zionists, are scared to death of Mr. Corbyn becoming the next prime minister of Great Britain, because they know that he will not stand for the abuses, the human rights abuses and the war crimes that Israel has been engaged in for so long. He will end it. He will stand up and speak. And they know that this is a battle that they do not want to lose. And so they have been smearing him and his close inner circle and some of the most active and important members of the Labour Party with this nonsense smear, which they believe will work, which is anti-Semitism. And today there's this whole debate. People are calling him Nazis. People are calling him Hitler. People are calling him all kinds of crazy names. And the man has never said a word against Jews. There's not a racist cell in his body. And he never denied the Holocaust. They talk about Holocaust denial. But he did stand with Palestinians. And he did make his point very, very clear that the human rights abuses and the war crimes of Israel must end.
The latest attack against him, and there are many, is that he, and this is from your article, is that he attended a memorial for terrorists. You write, quote, "Netanyahu, along with what may well be the loudest Zionist mouthpiece in Britain, the Daily Mail, claims that Corbyn was present at a ceremony and even laid a wreath on the graves of terrorists connected with the 1972 attack on the Israeli athletes during the Munich Olympic Games," end quote. Explain the truth here, please.
Well, this was 2014, and he attended a ceremony to commemorate the killing of dozens of Palestinian and Tunisian citizens who were killed when Israel raided the headquarters of the Palestine Liberation Organization in Tunis in 1985. This is a raid that was denounced all over the world, including by the United States. Even the United States called them out on this and said it was wrong, and even at some point they called it a terrorist attack. So this was denounced by the entire world. Many people were killed, and he was at the cemetery in Tunis to commemorate the killing of these people. The Daily Mail took a picture of him with a wreath and also took a picture or placed a picture next to that of four graves of Palestinians that were assassinated by Israel. And then Israel claimed that they were among the planners of the attack on the Olympic Village against Israeli athletes in Munich in 1972. There's not a shred of evidence that they were involved. there was no trial, of course. They were all assassinated by Israel or by proxies. But that's it. So now the Daily Mail said Corbyn attended and laid a wreath on the graves of these terrorists who were involved in the killing in Munich. That's it. Now it's out there. Then all the other British papers repeated this, and now this is a thing. Jeremy Corbyn supports terrorism. Not a single one of the people who were involved in the terrorist in that attack are buried in that cemetery. But those other four that Israel assassinated are there, and Israel claims it. So now Israel claims it, so that's it. So now the whole world has to accept that this is the truth. And so that is the reality. That is actually what took place. But now that they've put it out there, everybody's got to, you know, hurry up and defend him and explain the facts, which, of course, are a little more, takes a little more time, a little more complex than a Photoshopped picture and a headline, which is, you know, sensational. But there was nothing, there's not a single bone in his body, not a single cell in this man, not a single moment in his very long and distinguished history as an activist and a politician that would suggest he supports terrorism, he supports anti-Semitism, or he supports Holocaust denial. But all of these things have been laid at him, and he's been labeled with all of these things by major Jewish forces, Zionist forces within the Labour Party and in the UK.
To give the audience an idea of how aggressive this attack against Jeremy Corbyn is, now we're talking, he's in the Labour Party in the United Kingdom, okay? In today's Washington Examiner in Washington, D.C., there's an op-ed. The UK's Labour Party has effectively become a hate group, and this was written by Michael Rubin. Quote, while the Palestinian cause and the quest for a two-state solution has attracted a broad array of activists over the years, Corbyn joined its genocidal fringe, embracing Hamas, a group which seeks not only the eradication of Israel, but the murder of Jews worldwide. He continues, it's clear that Labour has an anti-Semitism problem and perhaps more broadly, a hostility toward the Western liberal order. But is it fair to castigate it as a hate group? Yes, it can be held to the same standard as previous political movements and groups which have likewise promoted intolerance and hatred. This is an op-ed in an American newspaper about a guy who may wind up being Britain's prime minister. They're going international on this, and they're going full speed ahead.
Yeah, they're pulling all the stops. They are terrified. Now, they've created a reality, the Zionists and their agents around the world, including here in the United States. They've created this strange reality where they know what's good for the Jewish people, and they will determine what's good for the Jewish people. And if you oppose them, you're an anti-Semite. And they will define what anti-Semitism is as well. So it's not like anybody can come up and say, well, anti-Semitism is this, that, or the other. You have to follow the specific guidelines that the Zionists approve. Now, this attempt, this article, of course, is full of lies. It's a complete fabrication. There's not a single, in the entire part that you just read out, there's not a single word that is truthful. But here in the United States, there's this acceptance of this sort of politics because people kind of are accustomed to the Zionists and the State of Israel being involved and being interfering in American politics. Far more than, say, the Russians or anything like that. So it's kind of accepted, and people just don't worry about it. They somehow think it's okay. In Britain, people are not used to this. And you know, I had this conversation with a Labour Party member in the UK. And by the way, I'm going to be there. I'm going in a couple of weeks because they're having the Labour Party conference in Liverpool next month. And he was saying, you know, we're not used to this. This doesn't happen in Britain. I said, well, it's happening now. So, you know, welcome to the club, and you guys better be prepared to fight this because they are relentless.
Corbyn was also criticized for participating in an event with the late Hajo Meyer, a Jewish Holocaust survivor himself. This was in 2010. Explain how ridiculous condemning Corbyn for engaging with Meyer. How ridiculous, how far they'll go to paint Corbyn as evil.
Yeah, Well, this is a Holocaust survivor who was very active. He passed away, sadly, who, like many Holocaust survivors, actually opposed the state of Israel, reject the state of Israel. He was an activist that spoke against Zionism. And supported the cause for the struggle for justice in Palestine. And so attending a Memorial Day for the Holocaust, Memorial Day event with him is wrong. He also made a mistake by attending. He went to a, you know, Passover Seder, the Passover feast, but he went with a group, with a Jewish group of his constituents, within his constituency, you know, he's a member of parliament, Corbyn, that did not agree that the Labour Party had an anti-Semitism problem. So he was criticized for going to a Seder with the wrong group of Jews. In other words, with Jews who don't agree with the Zionist line. So that's also a criticism. You know, it's reached such levels of absurdity. And what I think they're expecting is that because these accusations are so absurd and because they keep coming, people are going to start saying, well, maybe there's something to it. So I think to counter this and to make it absolutely clear, these are lies, absolute, categorically, these are lies. And the Zionists are very good at this. They will come out and they will attack somebody because they know and they feel threatened. It's just like they call the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, the BDS movement, anti-Semitic. There's nothing anti-Semitic about it. It's a call for justice and freedom and equality. This is how they act. And now they pulled out all the stops. And what's interesting is that the British public obviously is not interested in any of this because the membership is at an all-time high. You know, 800,000 members only since he became, and it's growing all the time since he became leader. So I think they're going to fail. I think this is a battle. This is one bridge too far. I think this is a battle that the Zionists are going to fail. I certainly would do anything I can to support this man because I think he's a great man. He's a great leader. And if he does become the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, it's going to be a game changer for Palestine for sure, but also for the rest of the world and certainly for the Brits. I think the Brits are going to have a leader of the sort that you get once in a lifetime.
Explain, and you've touched on this, but if you could elaborate a bit on why you believe having Jeremy Corbyn as the Prime Minister of Britain would be such a game changer for the Palestinian cause.
Because he speaks up for the Palestinians. He's not afraid. He speaks up for justice everywhere. He speaks up against injustice everywhere. He speaks up for people who are in need. He speaks up for the many, not for the few. And he is not afraid to speak up against Israel and to call Israel on its crimes. And he will do so as prime minister. There can be absolutely no question about that. And to have a prime minister of England, you know, who in many ways is considered to blame for the problems that Palestine has to begin with,
mm-hmm.
Under their watch that it all began. To have somebody like him as prime minister will be a complete game changer. He will not stand for all this, for the human rights abuses. He will call Israel on its crimes. And hopefully, and the fear I'm sure that they have, and the hope that we have, that people like myself have, is that this will inspire and encourage other leaders, world leaders, who know what he knows but are afraid to speak up, to actually speak up and call Israel out on its crimes.
You wrote that you consider this to be a war of attrition. Why?
Because they have really unlimited resources. And they are going at it and going at it and going at it and going at it. And their expectation is at some point, some people on our side, the Corbyn supporters and the voters will say, okay, fine, we give up. No, because they never give up. They have resources that are unlimited, both in manpower and in money. And they will just keep going and going and going and going and going in the hopes that the other side will just give up because it's tiring. You have to deal with this all the time, the letters, the emails, the tweets, the complaints from all these Zionist organizations everywhere, the threats. At some point, people are going to say, you know what, just have this guy Zion as leader. Let's move on. Even threatening with splitting the party.
You mentioned, well, you talk about threats. Do you believe that the Zionists within the Labour Party are trying to create an environment where harm becomes Jeremy Colburn.
Yes, exactly. They want to create an environment where the Labor Party will say, you know what, it's got to go because it's not worth the fight. We have more other issues that are more important to us as Brits. You know, we're just gonna.
No, I meant physical crime. I meant physical harm.
I don't think Israel would dare harm British politician of that stature. Israel wouldn't dare. I think that is, if it maybe it was some other country, I wouldn't put it past them. I mean,
really,
fascinating. But the British politician, they wouldn't dare. They absolutely wouldn't dare.
Hmm. Okay, I'll trust you on that one, because I in my mind, I wouldn't think that there's anything that they wouldn't do to further their cause.
That they wouldn't dare. I mean, they'll make up stories about women and alcohol. I mean, they'll make, who knows what they're going to do. I mean, they're going to pull out all the stops. I don't think we've seen the end of it. You know, the convention is in three weeks,
mm-hmm.
And it's already heated beyond belief. So who knows what else they're going to do? They're going to pull all the stops, but that they're not going to do.
Wow. Okay.
Or physically, leader or somebody of that stature, that they will not do.
Let me switch to another issue related, but another issue. UN ambassador to the United Nations. I'm sorry, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, has said that the right of return for Palestinian refugees displaced since 1948 is an issue that should be taken off the table. This is according to the Times of Israel. Your thoughts on this position?
She can take whatever issue she wants on the table or off the table. It makes absolutely no difference. The issue of the refugees is an issue that is a key, fundamental issue. There will be no end. There will be no solution to the question in Palestine until the refugees are allowed to return to their homes and their land and are paid the compensation they deserve for 7 decades of displacement and living in refugee camps. Until that happens, that this is the key number one issue. That is one issue that she can do whatever she wants. That issue will always be the central issue, and there will never be any kind of agreement, any kind of solution without this key issue being resolved. And so she can do and say whatever she wants. It makes absolutely no difference.
So help me understand this, and I ask that as sincerely as I possibly can, because I've heard that about recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. I've heard that about moving the American embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. I've heard that repeatedly about the continuing expansion of settlements. And it seems as though the world is appalled at all of these things, but they just continue to happen. And the Israel being declared a Jewish state, the movement of the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and now this position about taking the right of return off the table, all of this happens under the Trump administration. So it just seems as though Nikki Haley is pushing this button as far as she can possibly push it.
Well, the Trump administration Trump, I think, and Netanyahu have very close relationships. There's this love affair between the two. And I think many of the things that you mentioned are happening as a result of that relationship. Certainly moving the embassy to Jerusalem and recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel was a personal political favor from Trump to Netanyahu. And this too, now they're talking about only recognizing 500,000 Palestinian refugees as refugees. They're saying all kinds of nonsense. It's not going to make any difference because there's a certain reality. And the reality is that there are 5 million refugees who deserve to go home. And nothing will be resolved until they go home. Nikki Haley is going to come and go, and Trump is going to come and go, and the state of Israel is going to end up going, and the refugee issue will be resolved, and these people will be allowed to go back to their homes. I think it should be made absolutely clear that this is actually going to happen, and I think it's going to happen sooner than most people think. But this is the hyperbole now. This is how people talk. You know, they try to they're pretending Palestinians don't exist, and they're giving Netanyahu absolutely everything he wants, every statement that he wants. as though the Palestinians will one day disappear. They're not disappearing. They're uniting. They're strong. They represent the they're really the majority of the population under Israeli control today. The majority are Palestinians. Israel just passed a racist law, one more racist law, but a constitutional law that defines it really now even more than before as an apartheid state. But it's not going to make any difference. The Palestinians are still there. The land is still Palestine. And the refugees will return as part of a resolution of this issue. There can be absolutely no doubt about that.
Haley also referenced U.S. aid cuts to Palestinian refugee agency UNRWA, which estimates that there are at least 5 million Palestinian refugees alive today. This is a figure that Haley disputes. Cutting this aid, again, is just another tactic that it seems like Trump is trying to make life just so deplorable that people cry uncle.
Yes, well, life is deplorable for Palestinians already. You know, I mean, 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza with no access to water or electricity in this incredible heat is already, I mean, life for Palestinians is terrible already. And so this additional step that they're taking with UNRWA is criminal. At the same time, you know, the Palestinians are quite happy not to receive this humiliating aid. They're quite happy to return to their homes. So if they want to stop the aid, I think that could be a part of a larger solution, which allows them all to return to their homes. And the rest of the compensation that they need to get, they can get from the $4 billion that the U.S. gives Israel in terms of foreign aid, which Israel really doesn't need. So, I mean, if it's part of a solution where the refugees can go back to their homes, which is what they're quite happy to do, then, yes, they're not going to need this aid anymore. But you can't take away the aid and turn them into, you know, they're already starving. They're already living in refugee camps all over the Middle East, you know, Palestine and around it in horrifying conditions. And there's no excuse, there's no justification, there can be no explanation that possibly justifies the conditions in which these Palestinian refugees live.
And this is where Jeremy Corbyn's voice becomes so critical on the world stage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. To counter this Trump mania, this Trump-Netanyahu mania that's allowing this reality to continue unchecked, he will put a stop to it, or he will at least call them out on it.
Wow. So, Nico Peled, thank you so much for your time. And your piece in Mint Press News, Anti-Semitism Charges Against Jeremy Corbyn Are Diversion from Israeli Occupation of Palestine. Hey, man, as always, thank you for your voice. Thank you for your work. And you're always... you're always there when I call and invite you on, so I always appreciate that.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Again, folks, Mint Press News, Anti-Semitism Charges Against Jeremy Corbyn Are Diversion from Israeli Occupation of Palestine. Miko Peled is the author of that. Also, if you really want to get some insight into this issue, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, is a fantastic book. The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, is Miko Peled, P-E-L-E-D, P-E-L-E-D. Hey, folks, you need to let your friends know that we're here on Radio Sputnik, and Radio Sputnik is a place that they can turn for some real, real progressive analysis on the issues. You're going to hear things, hear people, hear guests that you won't hear anywhere else, or read anywhere else, right here on Radio Sputnik. Hey, you've been listening to The Critical Hour. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space, and I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all tomorrow, right here on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.